the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is episode 235.
Lawrence Labs. That's right, we are broadcasting or podcasting from Lawrence Labs Studios in lovely
Lawrence Labs.
I was thinking city.
Oh yeah, city is Southgate.
Southgate, Michigan. That's right. We're at Tony's. In other words, we're at Tony's place.
Yeah. Or Tom's place.
Tom's.
Yeah. Cool. But you know, it's actually Tony lives in Southgate too, so
yeah,
you're not
true.
Far.
Yeah.
You're not farly wrong.
Yeah.
So this is actually Southgate because I was thinking it was Riverview.
Riverview is across the street. This is Southgate's border.
Oh, okay.
We're on the edge.
Okay.
We're on the edge.
How appropriate.
What?
So
more
nice,
edgy.
But this is a nice little studio setup you got, Tom, and so it'll be fun. But anyway.
This is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
And Tom Lawrence.
Got to make sure we get that in.
Yep.
So.
Get our intros going.
That's right. It's been a few weeks since we've
been
posted,
in studio.
Oh yeah, we've been in studio, right? Because we've been doing a lot.
Yeah, we were at PenguinCon. We did a podcast from PenguinCon.
Yep, that one's published. The Live and Zesty from PenguinCon 2017.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then we went to Microsoft Build.
We did, which yeah. is kind of, well, it wasn't scary, but it was just different.
Yeah.
It's weird being a Linux people, and we found a fan of our show. We feel there may have been more than one. If there's one, there's others.
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
one recognized us.
We know you're out there.
We wore our shirts, so we made ourselves recognizable. It wasn't by our voices.
Yeah, so we did. Yep, and so we did. We recorded some podcasts out there, which we'll be playing over the course of the next few weeks.
Yeah, we'll get some of those posted.
Fresh looks.
Awesome interviews. Mm-hmm. It was a really good time.
That's right, it was. And it just surprised me how much different it was than what we expected. And you're going to get more, you know, we'll explain ourselves completely throughout those episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We'll explain ourselves completely.
Why we
appear to go over to the other side.
No. Right.
Which I think the interesting thing for me, the big takeaway being a Linux guy, was that Microsoft didn't change us. We're excited about what Microsoft's doing because they're coming onto our side. They open source things. They're published on GitHub. They're the most active. It's the other way around. It's like I feel as though Microsoft came to our side. We were polite to our guests and saying, so what does it feel like to be on the losing side, guys? Because, you know, we were talking this open source before you guys were. We were polite to our guests. But, it really is. They open source a lot of things.
Right. Yeah.
And they're realizing the value of it. It took them a little longer than it took us. That's all.
Yeah, and you know they had great swag there.
I want
everybody to know who's not watching, which probably is a lot of people. I am wearing an SQL, MS SQL,
but an SQL,
but
shirt.
An SQL shirt. Now, what's funny about this shirt is that there are just these tiny SQL databases. The whole front of the shirt has been imprinted with little SQL databases all lined up, and then the back of the shirt there's nothing. So it's pretty funny, but they had a lot of great swag there. We got a lot of stuff. I came away with 7 t-shirts.
Yeah. I think I came home with like 20.
Yeah.
Cause I got like 3 and 4 of a lot of them.
Okay.
Yeah. I only grabbed a few t-shirts, but I did get lots of stickers, which was my exciting thing. Cause our server case in the back is starting to slowly turn into like a NASCAR sponsorship looking thing. We got stickers all over it.
Mm-hmm. You say case. It's not just a case. It's a whole rack.
Yeah. It's a whole server rack.
Server rack.
There's a lot of space to fill because generally stickers are designed to go on laptops and small things. Mm-hmm. So having a giant full height server rack, it's got a lot of stickers on it.
I like the SUSE sticker because, you know, there were I think two Linux vendors there. SUSE was there and Red Hat. Mm-hmm. Canonical was strangely missing. But, of course, Tom, you had the joke. They might be in a boardroom somewhere discussing.
Yeah, we were finally hanging out with somebody at Microsoft.
Right.
I feel as though, because I keep hearing these announcements that they're streamlining for efficiency, but it's more like I think.
Companies usually do that when they're on the bid to be acquired.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're on a bid for IPO.
Yeah. I think, that which would be kind of freaky if that. Well, I don't know. I don't know. But suffice it to say, it was an interesting event for us. I ended up winning a laptop the last day.
That is so cool.
Yeah.
I am jealous.
16 gigs of RAM. half a terabyte solid state drive. It's like a, it was a pretty expensive laptop I got, but I have already gone ahead and I have, this is a Microsoft laptop, but I've already gone ahead and disabled secure boot. So now when it boots up, there's this big red banner across with this open lock.
Uh-huh.
It looks kind of, it's designed to make you feel kind of scared.
You're like, yeah, I've opened up my laptop.
That's right. That's right. And part of the next step too is I've already disabled BitLocker, which is their encryption product or service. So, and that's just in preparation for installing, I think I'm going to put OpenSUSE on it and create a dual boot situation. So, that's all I've been able to do thus far, but my next step will be to put that on there. So, and I'll keep everybody updated.
Yeah. All right.
So, yeah. And I don't know if we've transitioned to what we've done, over the last 2 weeks, but one last thing I want to mention to you, this is kind of exciting. Tom, I know you're always on top of the news, so you may be aware of this, but Plasma, KDE Plasma now allows you to add your Google Drive in.
Yes.
I set that up yesterday.
How's it work?
It works pretty good. Now, I had to fix my KDE wallet because I kind of hate I kind of hate KDE wallet most of the time, but it does help keep my passwords. But the problem is that for some reason the password I used for the overall wallet wasn't working, so I had to delete it and put a new one in there. And once I got that set up, then it installed perfectly. It's in my left panel in Dolphin. I click it. There's all my stuff. I connected, of course, with my Google account, and all the stuff is there, just as if it was on my hard drive.
It's still on my. I've been looking at all the advancements, and some people have been doing some working reviews of like the KDE Neon of saying it works. Like the bugs in it, none of them are showstoppers anymore. Like it's solid, it's stable, which is a huge deal for me because I need something that doesn't cause me drama.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand. I understand what you mean. But anyway, so that was the other thing that I did over the course of the last couple, you know. Well, actually, I did it yesterday. So that pretty much sums it up for me.
All right.
What about you, Tony?
Anything else?
I'm doing a lot of prep for my next trip. It's taking us like 2 hours a night for the last 4 nights to just put together all the paperwork for the kids that are, or for the people that are going to be watching my kids.
Oh.
Because we're going to Italy this week. We fly out on Thursday. And so to make sure that the schedules are set up right so everybody knows when they're picking up kids, dropping them off, you know, make sure if you know that they know what to do with each of the kids. Because you get to know your kids, and then you feed them.
Usually
you know,
that's what happens. Oh,
but
yeah.
You feed them a certain way. You get
The routines.
Now you send them off to somebody else, and if they don't know their routine of what kids to are gonna eat be and stuff, then...
upset.
Yeah.
Have you been... prepping your kids for your departure?
We have been. We've been talking about, you're going to be going over here, you're going to be going over there.
But you should be able to set up a Google Hangout maybe partway through the trip and say hi to your kids, right?
That's what we're doing. And
cool.
Because we're not sure like how the different services are going to work, we have three
in Italy?
Different,
yeah,
we have four different video chat systems set up that we're going to be able to chat. We have Skype, Google Hangouts, there's one called Viber, which it's been told that works really good over there.
Okay.
So that's probably the one we're going to rely on.
Yeah.
And then my wife and has an iPhone, so, you know, last-ditch effort
like,
is iChat or whatever.
Sounds like you got it covered.
Are you calling it Project Rome? I seen you looked at that with the build. There was a project at Microsoft release called Project Rome. And Tony went right over there. He's like, I'm going there.
I did. I'm like, And they had a picture of Rome behind in the background. But they're like, yeah, it has nothing to do with that.
Yeah, no, but that's one of their open source projects.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, that was actually really interesting.
It is. It's the basis for a lot of different things. I'm actually going to do a review of it because I started reading into it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So,
That should be interesting, Tom.
Yeah.
Okay, so Tony's going to be going to Italy. when are you coming back?
June 12th. Yeah, the 12th.
Ooh,
will be
okay.
So it's,
that's 2 weeks.
Almost 3 weeks.
Almost three.
It's like 2 days short of 3 weeks.
Okay.
So it's going to be a long time without the kids, but a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have fun, too, because they get to go stay at the grandparents for
they'll have fun.
They get to have an adventure.
Yeah.
Excellent.
All right. So, Tom.
All right, Tom.
Besides building Lawrence Labs, which pretty much what occupies my life before I left for the Build conference and then still after, we've had a... It's just been crazy because everything's been causing little delays because of clients that one of my clients bought another company and then decided to upgrade all their computers, servers. And then they go, oh yeah, on another side of the company, we want to buy a warehousing program. So like the amount of level of work that we're doing has been through the roof. So we were here last night, just finishing off cleaning up the place till 9:30 last night. Like we worked all day Saturday, you know, so it's just been, it's really hard because we want to do everything ourselves and we were really slow when we started the project. And then a couple of our customers just, hey, they signed $1 million contracts, which is good news for us because now they have money to buy all the things.
Yeah.
And then other servers went out. And then for another client that said they, we told them we should get rid of their 2003 Windows server. And it got rid of itself. It,
oh, that doesn't sound good.
They're like, can we reload it? I'm like, look, it's long past end of life. No, no. We've told you to replace this thing like years ago.
Oh, there's security. There are also security vulnerabilities that they might experience
too,
right?
It's actually none now because it doesn't turn on.
Oh.
It has now become immune to all security problems.
I guess they're now secure.
But of course, you know, their problems create emergencies for us. So it's been like one thing after another after another. But we're still having a lot of fun. We're, everything's getting done. Obviously, we're recording here now. We don't have all the right microphones set up. We had some trouble with the live show, but it's these are all the learning experiences and the ideas and inputs from Tony and Mary. And then Phil was here yesterday hanging out because then Phil had problems and his computer died. His brand new high-end, like really high-end motherboard and everything died. So Phil hung out with us yesterday while we sorted out problems with it, which we couldn't. It's just it's a bad motherboard. And it's like, well, top of the line gigabyte.
Is that the one he got from work?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, so it's no money out of his pocket.
Well, here's the thing. Work reimbursed him. So he has to buy it and then work reimburse him.
Oh, okay.
So work also says, well, send it back. It's under warranty. So he's got to send it back to Gigabyte. He's been using it for almost a month now. So that puts it past the 30-day return policy. And he has to mail it directly to manufacturer now.
And it doesn't boot. So it's not like he can pull stuff off of it unless he's got backups or something.
The good news is he
Hard drive out? And...
Yeah, he can do all that because he actually assembled it himself. It's a really nice, cool, cool build. So. And then I upgraded my computer. I did that just before we left. And so I have a nice, really high-end computer for editing for videos and stuff. It's really cool, because we take – because you can do, I tried re-rendering a project. So the project that took 18 minutes to export took 4 minutes now. So I'm like, yes, I'm excited. And, you know, I finished my office and that. I posted some of that on my YouTube channel. And so that was kind of what my last – since the last recording's been. It's just been just – so much. Oh, and I'm speaking tomorrow at Detroit Startup Week. I'm on a panel about podcasting. So I got invited from there. I know some people there, so I'll be attending Detroit Startup Week, which if you're not familiar with what Startup Week is, there's a huge list of cities, and Startup Week is a big get-together for entrepreneurs, people who want to start a business or maybe have a small business, want to expand it, and they just put a bunch of entrepreneurs and pitching ideas and hanging out in panels, and they have people who are other entrepreneurs like myself speaking on those panels and, you know, giving out advice, and they have kind of like a coffee shop hangout tables where we just all hang out and talk. So it's fun.
Nice.
They did it. I was last year was the first time Detroit had that event. We had Bill Ford speaking. We had the mayor, Detroit City mayor there. Like a lot of good people up on stage talking about the different innovations that are going on. So definitely the keynote and everything was a lot of fun. I'm excited to be at the event. I ended up on Chase Bank's website. They said, you seem enthusiastic. And I'm like, I am. I'm excited to be here. I don't know what that is. So when someone said it to me, that's my instant reply. They're like, do you like being on camera? I said, I love cameras. And so
I've never met a camera I didn't like.
Yeah. I'm like, what are you guys doing? So they brought me in the other room and said, say a few words about Startup Week. And I got all excited. And Chase Bank thought it was cool because they were one of the big sponsors. So they tweeted it out and they embedded it on their website, come down to Detroit Startup Week. And it's me saying, come down to Detroit Startup Week.
That's cool.
Oh, fun.
So then I retweeted it, which I rarely retweet anything. I'm not on Twitter that much. It's kind of random. Twitter's where I find jokes.
I'm heavily on Twitter.
It's where I find jokes, and it's where I find out if something's down. Like, you know, whenever, like, is Skype not working? I don't know. Hashtag Skype down. Oh, look, I found the hashtag. What was down the other day? Something was. But, like, that's what Twitter's for me. Like, is something down? And I join the down for me too party of hashtags. So that's about it. That's my excitement.
Cool. All right. Good. Excellent. Well, I guess it's time for us to move on to...
We want to hear from you. Call 734-258-7009 or email show@smlr.us with your feedback and questions.
That's right. It's time for feedback. And what do we have for emails the last couple weeks?
So much from us. Hold on, going through. We have like the people that we're going to be doing an interview with are there. That's cool. Some and spam.
That's actually pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Those people are going to do an interview with it's. Which one was it? I'm looking through my emails now. Yeah, it's really interesting, but I can't really talk about it.
Yeah, really interesting. We can't talk about it.
Well, I'm sure we. Where'd it go? Sometimes it's when we record out of studio or have we're out of our normal routine trying to keep up with those bits of feedback can be a little more of a challenge.
From Tom. Did we read that one last night? That would have been on May 3rd. I think we read that.
I think so.
No, yeah.
Tom Lawrence. So, Tom, what did you write?
Tom O.
I don't think so. I don't think we recorded
I think that was
then.
The last one. Because he, I love it. He signs it Obi Tom Kenobi.
Oh, yeah.
That's how he signs it. So, I'll just go ahead and read it. I'm not one to write to a show and listen to, and I think that a problem with most podcast listeners. We take advantage of the luxury of free content and learning and entertainment. So I'm asking my fellow listeners to take a couple minutes out of their day to give a contact link on the shows you enjoy listening to and hosts and let them know they're appreciated for doing something that you find worth. As for SMR, I've learned so much over the years. I've listened and I appreciate the hard work you all put into it and look forward to each episode release. Please keep up the great work, guys and gals. So, yeah, I agree with him because I'm bad about this, too, and I've tried to be better. His email mentioned to me, I'm a big podcast consumer. And which, side note, the podcast app, I've listened to over 20 days in 7 hours with the podcast when I checked the other day.
Wow.
Yeah. Since when? Since?
That's in the last year and a half I started using that app.
So it's kind of nice. It keeps track of that elapsed time.
Cumulatively 20 days worth of podcasts. I forget how many hours that is, but that's a lot of hours. And it's actually not measuring. It's measuring what it tells me how much it would have been. It's like 30-something days if I didn't listen to podcasts played faster. So it has all the statistics in there, which is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. But I do consume a lot, so I've been trying to. And this is where I do tweet. I tweet back occasionally that I like the show or things like that. Because some of them seem to prefer Twitter over email contacts. But I've been trying to get into a little bit more of that. I also I'm going to call out a little bit, though, because I've tweeted some shows who haven't replied. And one of them is Steve Gibson. He usually reads the show corrections in errata, and he did not read. He had a correction that he did not correct still.
Uh-oh.
I both tweeted him and messaged him because he likes Twitter DMs and direct tweets. So I did both, and he didn't correct. But it's kind of funny. It corrected itself. It was a firewall he suggested. It did not have the feature at the time of suggestion. And a month later, I sent him another follow-up that the company added the feature. Oh. I said, so now I'm technically wrong. In case you ever want to go back and correct it, now I'm wrong. Because I said it didn't have the feature, and you said it did. And then a month later, they added the feature. So I think that's it for the show, though. But we do appreciate that. We do love listener feedback, and I'm guilty of myself of just listening to a lot of podcasts, enjoying the show, and kind of nodding my head along, going, "I agree with you," or "I don't agree with you," and then not.
Well, maybe because you're driving or something.
That's part
position.
Of it too. It's so much in the moment. All that's me driving in the car. That's mostly when I listen to podcasts, and on plane rides, but I don't fly very often unless I'm going to build.
Yeah.
Right.
And it was a lot of fun. I spent 7 hours plane riding because of the way I had to do the return trip to Myrtle Beach.
That's right.
Because it was connecting flights. And
yeah. How was that?
Less than thrilling. Wow. Tom doesn't like planes. Oddly, though, and I don't know why, this is the first time I've ever in probably 17 years not got sick on a plane.
All right.
Which is cool. Which I attribute to listening to podcasts. Which it's been so many years since I flew. I don't think I was listening to podcasts. I listened to podcasts and didn't play on my phone. And I don't know why, but I did not get sick. So that made me happy.
All right.
Landings make me really ill. But I'm ill and I'm fine. Like, I get off the plane, I'm fine. It's just that landing goes whoop. It drops my stomach when the plane drops every time.
Oh, okay.
Well, not every time anymore. It used to be every time.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that you got that problem solved.
Yeah.
Hold on, maybe one more.
Oh, that was our first feedback.
That was.
That was our first one.
I didn't see any other ones.
And thank you, by the way, thank you to Tom for his kind comments.
That's right.
That's my addition to it.
Oh. Thank you. Did we answer Andrew's VMware problem? I think Phil did.
I think so. That came in, what, in April, didn't it?
Yeah, that was in April.
Yeah, yeah, we got that one taken
okay.
care of.
Yeah.
I think that. Phil replied to that one because he had the mm-hmm. answers for that. So I think we're good on that. And I was right at the April one. So it was the...
Okay. So we're kind of caught up.
Yep, because we did that one at PenguinCon.
Oh, yeah,
that's
yeah.
Right.
And
that
yep,
episode's been
right.
released. So we covered that.
Cool. Well, then I guess we're moving on, right, Tony?
That's right. We're moving on to...
Distro Fever, where we cover the latest hot distro releases and news.
The distros. So, what did you guys see interesting the last it's been 3 weeks since we've been on?
Well, I'll just come right out and say it. you know, actually, there's something new here. OB Revenge. Did you see that?
I saw that, yeah.
And certainly, well, it's based on Arch, so that's got
it's
a little nice, nice positive check mark for
right.
it.
Right. I think the OB comes from the Open Box Window Manager.
Yep. I think you're right, Tony. I think you're right. And I did go out to their website, took a look around. It's definitely a newer distro. And I think their website, they use Weebly, so it's that little free website service, so they built it there. I checked their forum out. There's some activity on the forum, but you can tell it's a new release because I've not really seen this before. One thing too is they have got it set up for beginning users, and then also they say programmers too. So they've got some tools there that I think it looks like they're trying to reach a broad range of people. And one thing I do like, they use the Calamaris, that dashboard where you can take care of a lot of configuration. It gives you the ability to select what browser you want, what media player you want, that type of thing. So what they're trying to do is put more of a variety or at least more control in the user's hands. So I'm very much inclined to take a look at this as a distro review at some point. I know we've got a lot of interviews coming up that we'll be splicing in each week. So I'm going to put that on my list and take a look at it. And I think I've got a little bit of buffer time. So that one caught my eye.
So there's a couple weird ones. One is FreeNAS. They had their 10. They dropped it back down to it's a beta. And I did my whole intro review. Mm-hmm. And, the most common questions were, when is all these things going to work? And I really had no answers. And clearly the FreeNAS people didn't either because they got a little overly ambitious. But now they are announcing FreeNAS 11 release candidates. So they're kind of going in a different direction.
Maybe it was so bad that...
It
was
really,
it 10? What was
10
the...
was just an... they didn't want anyone calling it 10. They wanted everyone calling it Coral. But it became funny because everywhere inside the display it said FreeNAS 10 Coral. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to drop the 10. Coral. They wanted to have like a new platform. And then just so many things were incomplete and apparently unable to complete, even though they considered it a release, not a beta. So now they're going down to an 11, and there's probably going to be some drama for there. And they're calling it a release candidate with 11. So we're going to see, because I know they're doing some integrations from things that people missed from 9. And hopefully 11 has things like, I don't know, being able to change out a drive with the web interface, because it is a
RAID array. I wonder how, well, and that 10 or whatever it was supposed to be is a major release. And I know from experience, and I won't go into details, but I know as a project software implementation project manager, when a major release is released and foisted on the user base, I'll say, and what the group that I was with, the developers did is they tested it themselves, and it worked. But what they didn't do is they didn't put it in a more rigorous user testing, having the project manager like myself test it, where we know how the customers use it.
Right.
Because how developers, they'll say, okay, this works. Oh, yep. And when I press this button, this display comes back or I get this result.
Right.
But when users use it, they're going to use it in a different way. And that was not done.
Well,
so when I see FreeNAS having this problem, my mind immediately goes back to that. And I'm thinking some testing procedure or protocol must have been changed or something.
Yeah. Right. And it wasn't feature complete. That was a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Too ambitious.
Too ambitious. Well, if you're going to do a RAID array, you would think, because every previous version of FreeNAS for the last like 10 years, inside the web interface, you can swap out hard drives when they go bad. That's kind of the whole point of having a software RAID array with ZFS and all that to make it easy for end users. You had to use a ZFS command line to swap out the drives. And I'm like, that's not for your average home build user or small office person, because that goes beyond what a lot of people would have a working knowledge of how to do. So, yeah, that feature not even being in there. Oh, and by the way, you couldn't get the drive encryption working properly. That's huge. I mean, because I don't want, if a RAID drive goes bad, I want to send it back. I can't send it back with data. That wasn't working properly. So that was also super pain in the butt.
So what they did is, so as we said, the 10 was supposed to be a full rewrite from the ground up.
Yeah.
And because of the crash or the problems with that and people downgrading to 9, 11 is actually, they took the new features that 10 had, backported them to 9, and is now calling it 11.
Yeah. I thought they were just going to update the 9 series, because there's two supported 9 series. I think it's like the 9 point something, and then there's 9.1. Mm-hmm. I'm on the 9.1 train, and that one, they're backporting features in both. It's really weird, but they're still supporting all of them. You get less features in 9, but you get more features in 9.1, and then now they're going to 11. So I think this is going to be like a little bump in the roadmap, and then they're going to get back to sanity. The other thing, and this goes up to being, there's a new release of pfSense version 2.3.4, and they also announced what they're going to be doing in 2.5, and that has just caused a uproar of controversy. The pitchforks are out. We're forking your project because of the dumbest thing, in my opinion. And I did a video on this, and the comments are still flying on the video because people, not everyone's agreeing with me. I agree with the developers of pfSense. They monetize by selling NetGate hardware. That's a fact. And people think this is a money grab by them to try to force everyone on NetGate hardware. The AES-NI instruction set has been available in lots of processors for almost 16 years. So it's been around for a while, but it's not available in your low-end processors, with the exception of the Atom series processors. So all these people who like have mobile processors, I don't understand. I did not know this many people ran pfSense on laptops, but apparently they do. They don't have that AES-NI. The 2.5 version, they announced, is going to require it. But they agreed to support the 2.4 series that doesn't require it probably till the year 2020. So you have about 3 years to figure it out. And the 2.5 requires a AES-NI compatible processor. But seeing as that processor has been out for 16 years, processors with that structure set, you can find $50 computers all day that will run this. And people are like, we're going to fork the project so it doesn't require the support. You're just trying to do a money grab because your NetGate products have it in there. And, you know, it's not like we need it for VPN. If we're not using VPN, why should we have the support in here? And because they've had the support for a long time, you can turn it on so it makes the VPN work faster. And it does AES decoding. But the people are just like so – like the amount of comments this is generating on this blog post. And they're just calling – oh, they went to a name-calling match. And people on Reddit had to be blocked and banned from the pfSense forum because they started calling his wife names. Like childish very quickly.
Jeez.
I thought it was, and of course the developers kind of like, you forked the project. It's open source. Go ahead. That's what the other guys did. It's already been done once because of design, you know, design disagreements. But they're doing it also for security. Their announcement is we're moving everything to processor-based AES instead of software because on all the different packet inspection things that we're trying to add to the 2.5 series, this prevents side channel attacks. There are known side channel attacks, and they cite the articles, that can be done with the software one. He goes, if we move to completely supporting in-processor AES, one, we only have to support one type of platform. It gives us a more predictable platform, and there's plenty of these things that are not NetGate devices available, and it's secure. So there we go. I'm fine with the change. It does affect a couple of firewalls we deployed that don't have that processor. Whatever, I got 3 years to figure that out.
Right.
So in the next 3 years, and maybe even longer, they'll have support. And that only means the support chain stops, you know. It doesn't mean I have to replace it. It dies in 3 years. I lose support for that series. Whatever.
Right.
Their current release also has a new feature. They're using the NetGate devices serial number to create support tickets. So not support tickets, but be able to add support. So pfSense is going to have the ability to look up the BIOS, and if you want to buy support from them, which is part of how they monetize, they give away an incredible product for free. Sure, they favor the NetGate products because the guy who does most of the development work also does that. But he's also a big kernel contributor back to FreeBSD. They contribute a lot of back to the open source project, not just to the pfSense project. So that's one of the reasons people always ask, well, are you going to switch, Tom? Are you going to switch to one of the forked ones? I'm like, no. I mean, they're literally not developed as well. like anything I've read in the forums, pfSense is further ahead than them, further developed. They split and just don't have the feature sets that pfSense offers or the support. So I'm sticking with the product. We're still deploying it at clients, and I'm still happy about it.
All right.
Wow.
So I know there's a lot to say on those two products. They're both the controversy in the forums, man. I just can't believe it went down to name calling. Like,
oh, yeah, that's gonna...
completely unrelated to open source, just calling his wife names in the forum. Like, really?
Wow.
Yeah. You know, and I'm going to just quickly change subject just for a second. Not subjects, but there's a distro, too, that kind of fell off the list simply because it was released earlier in the month, and it's called Farin OS. And actually, Tony, I thought of you when I saw this because it's based on Mint.
Oh, yeah.
Linux Mint uses, it's got the Cinnamon desktop. And this last release was called Murdoch, which I thought was kind of interesting. Murdoch. But they replaced the Mint welcome with the Farin welcome, other things like that. But, seemed kind of interesting as a release. I don't know if it's just simply Mint with, the branding slapped on it, which I kind of hate. I figure if you're going to do something, you might as well do it better. But they also, their website has, an OEM, it's called an OEM center. And it looks to me like they're moving toward putting this as sort of a default distro on laptops. So it's not, I don't think it's there yet, because when you go to the OEM center, they've got available laptops. There aren't any yet, but it looks like they're planning ahead. Maybe they shouldn't have turned that on, but that's a telegraph of perhaps where they're moving. So that one kind of caught my eye.
Very cool. It's been downloaded 33,000 times.
Farin OS?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
so
interesting.
Yeah.
But it's based on the Linux Mint, like Mint with Cinnamon. And I like Cinnamon.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it said, it includes Wine by default.
Yeah, I saw that too. So we'll see. They're going after a certain demographic. The fact that they've got Wine on there by default, then they've got this OEM center, so I kind of can see perhaps where they're going. We can kind of keep an eye on it and see how it progresses.
Right.
So
nice.
Okay, that's all I've got for the distros. Anything else, guys?
I saw that the Parrot Security OS 3.6 is out.
What?
It looks interesting. I always like seeing these.
Say it again.
Parrot Security? All right, I think that's the kind of joke where you just do it once, and that's good enough.
You're right. I like the the
Parent Security?
The security-based distros.
But, of course, I have to do it twice just to be annoying, and that's the last time. Go ahead, Tony.
All right. But, you know, it's a distro for pen testing and forensics analysis and stuff like that. So I think that's it's pretty interesting.
I suppose it does DDoS testing pretty well, you know. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Well, DDoS... this distributed denial service.
Yeah, but you
keep have to have more than one system to do that.
Can we get a bunch of parrots? That would be fun to have a parrot DDoS. I just, something about that sounds fun.
Yeah, right. It does.
All right.
Yeah, well, that caught my eye too. What distro is that based on? Do you have that info offhand?
It's based on Debian.
Oh, okay.
Ooh,
that's rock solid.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. I guess that's all I had.
All right.
So we're going on to
Tech News and Views.
Tech News.
Yeah.
So, Tom, I know you sent us a list of items you saw.
Yep.
I forgot to open it, Tom. I'm so sorry. I was writing my stuff.
That's
and
all right.
I saw it. I saw your notes.
I always share my... Well, and when I share them with you, there's still always more being added. So you just have to check, like, just before the show.
Okay.
Whenever, as I get here early, and then I'm like, going around adding my notes.
I'm going to see how much overlap we have then.
Yeah. So... I will start with the Doomsday Cloud Server. I like this. This is a fun article someone wrote. I didn't try any of the stuff in here, but he gives away the scripts and all that. The concept is...
He didn't try something with the name Doomsday in it?
I know. But this is the good Doomsday stuff.
Okay.
I've been looking into this myself, And what it is, you know, you end up relying a lot on the Google Cloud or Azure Cloud or whatever your back end is.
Oh, and you start what you did there.
Yeah. And but what happens is you go, all my data is there. What if it became not there? That would be a big problem. But my other side is, how do I store it all? So this guy kind of put a way to synchronize, back it up, and create a local copy. He's got Docker image guides and everything of how to pull all this with a little web interface, and it creates a synchronized copy of all your data connected at another data center, like backing up all your email and things like that. So it's that doomsday scenario where you lose
so
all...
So it's more than just like a Dropbox that has a local copy.
More than Dropbox. Because, for example, synchronizing email.
Yeah, I was just going to say... Dropbox is just simply files and things that are in folders.
Right. So okay. It's easy. You know, and Dropbox is creating a local copy. And we use sync things, mm-hmm. so we don't really keep any big data in there. My only thing we is my – I have one I wrote for the calendar, and I don't think he had a calendar in here too. So I might look at the project. I actually back up all my Google calendars and download them as iCal files. And mm-hmm. Google offers a way to do it that you can script. Oh. So I actually have a script I wrote with wget that actually pulls the entirety of each one of my calendars.
Uh-huh.
Because what if someone hacked my calendar? What if Google wasn't able to restore it?
What if those Russian satellites that suddenly started moving around are really weaponized attack satellites to take our internet down? Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Who knows?
I don't know how that tinfoil hat got on my head. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but being tinfoil hat like that, I have, you know, years of data that are valued on me in my calendar, all the different appointments and details, mm-hmm. and there's a way to download that. I have downloaded my entirety of my Facebook. I have a copy that I keep on certain. I don't know why I do that.
I just live life in a stream. If it's 2 days behind me, it's gone.
It doesn't matter. and I have there's a Python, I think it's written in Python script that I've used to back up entire Google Cloud accounts for clients. That's a pretty slick system. Uh-huh. But I thought about looking at what this guy's done and then adding to it some of the other scripts that mm-hmm. I'm aware of and increase. This might be – it's kind of a neat project.
And that's called what, Doomsday?
Yeah, it's called the Doomsday. It'll be linked in the show notes.
Okay.
It says, backing a cloud server with a Doomsday machine. And storage is getting a lot cheaper. I mean, the 4-terabyte drives now I think are just a little over $100. So you can go buy a handful of 4 terabytes.
I don't understand how they can get so cheap.
Oh, and it's only going to keep coming down. So – we're looking at, and even for one of our clients, we actually are going to be building a 40-terabyte RAID array for one of our clients.
Wow.
That, yeah, 40? They need that
wow.
much storage. That's a whole nother. When we have it, I'm going to do a YouTube video on it because there's a lot of details on what they're doing. They use drone imaging. They use,
okay.
They're also imaging.
So a lot of video, a lot of video
yeah.
type files are
yes.
really
Yes, they
large.
Also have entire videos of all the sewers for each city that they work in because they're civil engineers. So mm. they have there's like 400 gigs
including
of sewer
the
video.
Including Fraser one?
Yeah. So that whole project is interesting. Yeah. I want to do a whole detail as I learned about how that project's working, and I want to see if I can get them to talk more about it. Like, I would love to interview them, like, how they're doing. They're using drone imaging. They do daily LIDAR systems mm-hmm. to see if the ground moved. They can measure up to a 2-inch difference.
Wow.
And they do it every single day, rain or shine.
Yeah, for listeners who aren't familiar with that, what we're talking about is there was a big sinkhole that opened up by right near the city of Fraser, in the city of Fraser. And it was due to the collapse of a sewer pipe that was, I think it was like 40 inches across or
yep.
something. It was huge. Couple houses had to be demolished. It was just a really big issue. So that's what
the
we're
whole ground
about.
Just
yeah,
fell in.
Just
it's
fell
a giant
in.
Sinkhole because so. They've been washing it away. So mm-hmm. they're gathering all the data on that and the telemetry data and then storing it on these arrays. They've filled up the RAID arrays they have now. And they said, well, if we're going to build one, let's build a huge one. So,
mm-hmm.
but you can do that with this Doomsday machine. So before we get too sidetracked,
sorry,
no problem. No, I it's fun getting sidetracked. I won't lie. And it's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty cool project. And I mean, after I dig into it myself, I may contribute a little bit to it because I kind of got the same thing. I'm going to be able to back up all my business stuff. Then there's SlideWiki. This was kind of cool.
SlideWiki.
This is an open source project called the SlideWiki Project. And it's basically a slideshow system that's all open source that you can just drop right into a website and drop it like a wiki, but it,
okay.
like a slideshow. So if you have a bunch of slides for presentation and controls, and it's got all kinds of different features, and it's posted on GitHub. It's github.com/slidewiki. I just found it kind of cool. I think there's some crowdsourcing you can do with this, so multiple people contribute to it, but it's a web-based slideshow, all open source. So that's pretty neat. Bitwarden Password Manager. This looked interesting as well. It's an up and coming, and I don't have any. I have not used it, but it caught my eye as something interesting on GitHub for an open source password management system, and it's bitwarden.com. I don't crucify me. It's not secure. But I like it. I've been waiting for someone to do this, to start creating something that competes with some of the closed source password managers. And since the premise has been out for a while of how to do it. Like LastPass does a great job. LastPass is a product I like, I use. I think Tony uses it as well.
I do.
We use it at my office. They've got enterprise solutions. I'm using the paid version. But I still love an open source project, you know, and I'm willing to give plenty of money to these guys if it's secure and good. Always nervous, though, because there's a lot of critical information in LastPass. But nonetheless, it's something to take a look at. Hopefully people start poking away at it. And if with any luck, we can get someone like Tavis Orvinty or Steve Gitsum to really start doing some code analysis on it and just beat it up and say, hey, is it good? Is it bad?
Right.
Now, this is a fun one, too. The GNU GPL is a legal document as determined by the courts. That
was there a question on it?
There was a lot of questions on it, whether or not
it's legality as a contract or
whether or not it was a contract by simply downloading an open source project that contained it. You didn't really click on agree to the terms and conditions.
Oh.
So if I stole code from the GPL, would I be, how would you prosecute me? And so we have rulings, we have legal arguments, but line in the sand. And what this happened when a U.S. court upholds the enforceability of the GNU both as a license and a contract. That's the thing. So it's a legally binding contract of some company that was not properly following some of there. So I got the link to the two different articles about it, but it set some legal precedents that favors greatly the GNU GPL.
Well, now I'm thinking about that. Okay, it's usually embedded in, you know, in the software somewhere. But to get that software, you have to go to a site and download. So doesn't the site itself say...
Not necessarily.
Okay.
And what if you just looked at a segment of code and never downloaded it, and a code you're looking at had GPL in it, like I'm looking at the source on GitHub of a certain file, and I take a big section of that. Where did I click agree? There was a lot of fuzziness because it hadn't been, like, we know you shouldn't, and we know you should, you know, under this license, you should cite the source and keep it open source, blah, blah, blah. But that's not, you know, people have been not using it. Now they're making it enforceable. Yeah, you have to follow the rules. And so that's definitely, that's interesting to me that that was in there. Now, this is also cool. And high DPI, which is what using high-res screens. GNOME is really diving deep into this because this is one of the things that's keeping me from 4K unless I go to a 4K really big monitor.
Okay.
So I have three 1080 monitors and they're bigger monitors, so I don't have to worry about scaling issues. But when you put a 4K in there that's not as big, you go, okay, I need to kind of scale the menus. Well, now the GNOME project is doing fractional scaling on high DPI, which means I can scale each monitor individually. And I can do incremental fractional high-definition scaling, which is really cool. This is what you need for the GNOME project, seen as Ubuntu's moving all the way over there, and it allows scaling. Now, I actually used some of the current scaling in Unity for my this has a 13-inch screen on it, my laptop that I have, and it's 1080. Some things are really small, like the menu text. This allows you to apply larger menu text, but you don't want to enlarge the whole screen. You want the screen to not be enlarged because you don't want your videos on YouTube looking funny. You want them still at full 1080, but I want my menus readable. So this allows incremental scaling, and they're offering a lot more control in that. And with the 4K displays coming out, because with 4K, the menus are just... Yeah, they're like unreadable. You can't even see them. You want all those pixels, but you want menus that work. So they're really adding a lot of features, and the incremental scaling is a really cool feature that's coming out of this. What's next? Oh, OpenShot Video has a new release.
You took one of mine. I was going to tell you about that.
It's neat, but several people, this is a problem when I last tested it, I had this problem too. You know where the cut is, and when you're editing, the cut's right. The cut's wrong in the post-production. So when you export it, I thought I cut it this, and then it didn't cut there. So they've had some little bugs, and this is still some people I felt bad for the developer because he posted this on Reddit and then got flamed pretty hard for the problems at it, going, how do you call this release? Your cuts don't work right. We're working on it. It was because it was answering. I'm like, sorry, when you put something out for release and you want excitement, we were hoping, because that problem was already in the beta version, we thought it would be, when you call it a release...
Well, it's interesting you say that, Tom, because the article that I quoted is OMG Ubuntu, and what they said is they said these fixes will be warmly welcomed by users who want to use the app but find it's too buggy to rely on. But the problem, they said here, is that OpenShot is infamous for hyping reliability improvements with each successive release, only to literally fail at the first cursor-shaped hurdle on the user's desktop.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way to phrase it. And that's kind of what happens in there. And they're blaming – this is a big problem. When you base things on the MLT library, the MLT mm-hmm. library gets updated, and then they have to update the code. Now, with Caden Live, their solution was you use their repository, and it pulls down their own MLT libraries to avoid you having –
Well, that seems like a solid way to do it.
Yeah, they just
integrate them. You've got more control over it.
They've got more control. That way, they're building on the same version, because Arch Linux maybe has a newer version than mm-hmm. Ubuntu has, mm-hmm. so you have some disparity and problems. So – I generally find Caden Live to be really accurate on all that, and I don't have problems with it. So that's mm-hmm. why I'm still staying with Caden Live. I also had problems, and I haven't tested it lately, with you couldn't get to the frame level. And when you're trying to edit video and you want to do the cuts, you just drop right to the frame level. It wouldn't let you zoom in that far with OpenShot. And I'm like, I really need that feature because I need to cut things at a certain frame.
Yep.
And, you know, that's how you do it. Now, this was really cool. There is a... it's called, I'm going to see if I can pronounce this properly, which I'm probably going to get completely wrong. E-V-E-Z-O-R. Evezor? It's an open source robotic arm.
Evezor. I don't know. I just put the accent in a different syllable.
It's really cool.
It sounds like a new
yeah.
word.
Right. Their website is evezor.com. My guess is there's like these tools that go around looking for domains that are pronounceable and just find them. And I have a feeling that's how he found this.
Well, it's like pharmaceutical companies when they come up with a new drug name. What I found out, because with one of my companies I work for, we had pharma clients. And what they do is they... one of the things they like to do is have the name end with an A. For some reason, that's an easier to pronounce thing. But anyway, so go ahead, Tom. That just kind of cracked me up.
Yeah. So this is what's cool about this. Open source designs, everything. In the robotic arm is the most versatile thing ever. That was the whole goal. So he actually has 3D printing he's doing with it. He's got videos on all this, like a ton of videos. Plasma cutting. What you do is the robotic arm can mount, has a whole mounting system. So he's mounting, and it's very, like, lots of different holes in it, so you can rig up your own mounts on it. He has a welder. He stuck a welder in its hand and let it weld. Then he did a laser cut, glass etching, vinyl cutting, laser engraving, Bloody Mary making. Yes, he's got that on there.
That's funny.
And it also does training. He shows his kids moving the arm to show it the motions it wants to make, and then the robot will repeat those motions.
Really?
Yeah, so it's programmable. It's really, really cool. Like, this guy has put some work into it, and it's all open source, and really cool the way it articulates, the way the motors and everything work. I've never seen anything quite like this. It's a very different – it's not engineered like a normal robot arm, but it's got a Kickstarter, and I'm excited about it because we've talked about getting something that's kind of like a 3D printer, but then it's limited to 3D printing. This does everything. Like, he mounted a 3D printing head, and it does 3D printing at different articulating angles too. Because it doesn't just do XY, it's XYZ.
Nice.
And in a really unique way. And so it was an exciting project. I watched a lot of the guys' videos.
What's the name of it again?
Evezor. So definitely exciting. The last thing I had was the Ubuntu desktop team wants your feedback. This is actually over at omgubuntu.co.uk, link in the show notes. They want to know, and they're really looking for people's input on exactly how they want GNOME implemented with the new upcoming version of Ubuntu when they switch to GNOME. So they're looking for a lot of feedback. They have a survey of what features you like, what you find useful, what you don't find useful. They have a series of screenshots of would you find this feature or do you like that feature. So they're looking for a lot of public opinion, and they're going to shape it, which was a 100% swing from Unity of this is how it is.
Right.
I remember my favorite one. There's a comment Mark Shuttleworth had. Someone talked about how many pixels wide, and it wasn't very grabbable on Unity. And he says, that's the way it's designed, and close the ticket. So this is such a change from we're telling you how Unity is going to look, whether you like it or not, to, hey, guys, how should we implement GNOME on Ubuntu?
Yeah.
Which I think is great, though. That's what we want to hear. And there's a lot of input being heard. So that's exciting. The last little piece is with the WannaCry. And I'm sure Tony probably has a security article about it, but what's kind of funny is, did you see someone got it working in Wine and then submitted to the WineDB?
No way.
Yeah, so for anyone in Linux who's feeling left out watching the world burn down with WannaCry, and then it's now predecessor.
And they also WannaCry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, anyone who's had to deal with this.
I was going to ask you, Tom, I apologize for interrupting, but have any of your customers been affected by this?
So this is what's interesting. We have our managed service clients, which have all the protection on them, and knock on wood, table I think is wood. It's from
Micah. At least pressed wood.
Pressed wood. We had zero of any of our managed clients that we manage all the security for affected by this. Zero.
Awesome.
So we did good.
You're doing a good job.
Yeah. So we were happy. We watched the threats come in. We watched them trying to open dumb things like they always do, and it didn't.
Awesome. So I'm assuming there's another group of clients you have?
Oh, yes. The
the non-managed
client? We manage everything ourselves because we can update our own antivirus. I was just fixing viruses yesterday at a client who he didn't even know his employees uninstalled antivirus on like three of them because they were trying to load something. The thing they were trying to load, the antivirus was blocking, which was what it should have been done. And then the computers were goofed up because they loaded it. And he's like, how'd they get it on there with the antivirus? They uninstalled the antivirus.
Don't they have some kind of group policy that...
No, because they're clients that don't have any type of managed group policies or anything. They try to do all the work themselves. So they only call us in emergencies, which they have plenty of because they...
Well, I guess it's cash register time for you then.
Yeah, and that's kind of how it is. I told them, the problem is they don't calculate the service disruption time. They say, well, you only charge this much to come clean it up. It's only several hundred dollars. And I would have paid you because I haven't had a problem in 2 years this much per month, and it would have been more. So they're looking at that aspect, but they don't think about the fact that how much are you paying that guy? Well, he's salary. I said, what's he doing right now? Nothing. Mm-hmm. How many projects could he cannot do? Well, he didn't get anything done because I'm like, so there's probably a customer that was relying on him to get some design work done. Yeah. He's not doing it, is he? No. So we just pushed a project back a month for the client. I'm like, yeah, because he lost all the design files.
Oh, wow.
It's like hard to – I try to pitch it to them like
– sad.
It's the business disruption and the brand erosion of now that customer and you had to tell them you had computer problems. So But you can, if you're feeling left out, you can install WannaCrypt on a Linux box under Wine now. Apparently it's binary compatible.
Right.
It will encrypt your files. But because Samba is only a copy of the Windows SMB protocols, it won't affect the Samba. So you can't – it won't worm. It just encrypts.
Oh my god!
I know. Who so disappointing. We did take precautions here because people were bringing them in. We made sure one WannaCrypt wasn't on the network here. We run Linux on our network here, but we have a client side network. And what we didn't want is to have one client who doesn't have WannaCrypt infected by a client who does have WannaCrypt. So we actually immediately changed the password to our Wi-Fi as soon as it came out. That way, because some people when they come back, they have access to the client network. And we didn't want it to jump on and worm through other computers while we were patching them.
Right.
Now, just to make sure I understand, the attack vector for this is somebody clicking on a link in an email or?
Well, it's got multiple attack vectors.
Okay.
So WannaCrypt, first, it is sent as a lot of email attachments.
Mm-hmm.
Second, it's wormable. So if you have computers across the same network that both have Windows file sharing turned on and they're both unpatched, you can infect one computer and it automatically infects every other computer with that on there. And where that becomes a bigger problem is you'd think, oh, wait, why would anyone have SMB, exposed across the internet? Well, it turns out lots of people have SMB exposed across the internet, not behind firewalls. So that's what caused such a big uproar for this was back like Code Red and NIMDA. It took exposed services that should be behind firewalls, but for some unknown reason, they're not.
Yeah, it was bad.
I
still don't understand why you would have that open.
We don't understand why a lot of people do things, but it once again goes back to my clients that manage their own stuff. We've watched them. We had a client that plugged everything on the other side of a firewall. They came in and their tech friend helped them, and they plugged things on the other side of the firewall. And that was they just exposed computers directly with public IPs. They've done that. They were not supposed. Well, there wasn't enough ports. There was ports open on the switch that came off there, and they have multiple firewalls, and they plugged it into the switch before the firewalls. And the guy was actually smart enough to read the numbers and figured out that there was an IP address not used. So he used that IP address then to create a public IP address on his computer for stuff and then cause the problem.
Jeez.
We got there. We're like, who did all this? Like, this is so wrong. Yeah. So that's what I have for the news.
Wow, that's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I'm going to do a whole breakdown of the whole, I'm going to do a YouTube video about it because there's a lot of details and people, they have them wrong and I'm so annoyed by wrong details.
Mm-hmm.
And
Well, then don't look at my notes. No, just kidding.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's a guy that was talking about the money they made on it. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, they made, you know, millions and millions. I'm like, no, they didn't. Matter of fact, there's a lot of mistakes that were made. They had 4 hard-coded Bitcoin addresses, which is impossible. Like, normally the way these ransomware work is they create an on-the-fly Bitcoin wallet ID for each individual infected person. That way, they give you your Bitcoin ID, and they know when you paid because you put money into that ID given. And mm-hmm. I go, okay, you know, Mary did it. Now Mary paid the ransom. Now I paid. They only use 4 hard-coded IDs. Mm. So by doing that, it becomes super, super hard to figure out who paid and who didn't. It becomes a manual. You have to dig through the wallet. But that also meant for traceability, it was easy to follow. And someone set up a Twitter account that tweeted every time someone paid the ransom because there's only 4 of them. So they actually can just look at those 4 IDs very and good. Cumulatively know mm-hmm. who paid, which wow. they didn't amount to a lot of money.
There was like only $15,000 after the first couple yeah. of days or something. Yeah. It was a very small amount. Mm. And they said, well, wait till after the weekend.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It didn't yeah. amount to as much money as it could have. Also, we had the kill switch in there, which no one knows why they hard-coded a kill switch. There was a file that didn't even do a – it did a TCP connection but didn't actually look for any files. If a basically gobbledygook long domain was active, it would stop working. So when this guy registered this domain, he just bought this long domain that he found in there to see what would happen. It just stopped working. And he put a listener and everything on there, and he goes, yeah, it's just doing one TCP connection to confirm existence. That's it. It doesn't even look or doesn't ask for a file. If you create that domain, it stops. And that's actually what stopped the spread of it.
Really?
Yeah, which was fascinating. Like, why would they hard code that in there? So was it a proof of concept and you guys were going to throw the kill switch yourselves? This guy beat you to it? There's so many questions about it because we don't know who wrote it. There's just so much speculation and guessing. So it's a really interesting. That's why I'm going to do a breakdown of some of those details in there and just kind of like, here's all the details, here's all the things. That way I do a video because what I do is I'll post my video reply to the people who got it wrong. There's literally news companies reporting it wrong.
Right.
Well, jeez. I'm not surprised about that. Yeah. Only from the perspective that I've been involved in news events where you read the account of it in the media and they kind of get most of it okay, but then there are parts that are just not correct.
And it's the race to be first.
Yeah.
And what I don't like is they don't update, you know, the knowledge came out later because they got it first and now they're racing to be first on the next news item. So they don't go back and always mm-hmm. correct them. And it's, you know, there's a whole other discussion about the problems in media right now with the way they monetize clicks. But yeah, it does create a lack of in deep knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's why I appreciate people like Krebs on security. He's uncompromising. When he does a post, it's accurate. And if it's not, he updates. He'll have updated notes at the bottom. I've mm-hmm. always appreciated people like Steve Gibson, same way. When he reports on something, he has a rat on the next show to, you know, tell you anything mm-hmm. that may have been
right.
incorrect. That is due diligence. That's proper journalism. That's the way only way I want to operate.
Yep. Yeah. Good point. Okay. Wow.
All right.
I've got a few items here. One item. Let's see. You covered my other.
The open chat one.
Yeah. Well, there was a, yeah. Then there, of course, there's the obligatory article. You're talking about that WannaCrypt. It says it makes the easy case for Linux. Except I found this before you told me about the Wine.
Yeah. Well, they had to get it working. It was a project to make it work in Wine, which I thought was hysterical.
Yeah. But I'm going to move on to my next one. And this is Apple. I think they've been doing this for a while, but Apple is lobbying against the right to repair legislation across the country. I don't know if you've heard about
that.
Yes. And right to repair, it kind of is somewhat, as the name implies, means that you, as somebody who owns a piece of hardware or like a laptop or whatever device you have, should have the right to repair it, to have it fixed, and not be completely dependent on Apple for everything. So, and of course, for Apple, having that kind of control taken away means less revenue for you or less, mm-hmm. you know, less control over that. You know, that particular set of devices, whatever. But anyway, so yeah, so they're still trying to get around that. And they were talking about the amount of money that companies like Apple have put into to lobby for their side versus the amount of, or the lack of money that has gone in to lobby against it. It's really it's really a shame because that's how the big guys typically win.
Oh yeah, there's such a war with that right now. So
yeah, right. $336,000 between January and April to retain lobbyists for their position versus $5,000 for the Digital Right to Repair Coalition. Yeah, so they're the only organization sponsoring that bill.
This happened in 2006 or 2007 with the automotives. The automotive's proposed legislation that you couldn't, it was called the You Can't Open Your Hood Bill. And they didn't want to release the details of how, like, there's a manual basically that comes with every car made by, like, Chilton's is a popular company that makes them. And it's all the repair manuals and design specs so that you can have non-OEM parts. Well, the same concept. And good news is it failed because there was enough companies like AutoZone to go, wait a minute here. You know, we make a living selling the parts. And they wanted basically for the first 2 years the hood to be locked. You could only have your car serviced at the dealership for its first 2 or 3 years. I don't remember exactly how many years it was, but I remember signing up for the petition and protesting that. I'm going, that's really not – yeah, that's not favorable. So I'm hoping, you know, they beat it then, and I'm hoping we kind of beat this too, because you should have the right to repair your car or your phone or anything else. My understanding, too, from talking to techs, is they kind of live as they stock up Apple devices. Apparently, Apple has done this before. When you have too many screens, like a large repair shop, because it's technically you're running on the edge of legal, you shouldn't have all those Apple parts at your place, too. They have been stopped at the border when they shipped in, I was told by an Apple repair tech. Like, sometimes they can be a pain in the butt getting parts. And if you stockpile them, they can raid and say, you are legally holding parts that are not authorized by Apple to use, and we can just seize them.
What?
Yeah. I thought that was the craziest thing I ever heard. And I said, no, it's true. And they usually stop them at the border because they'll ship an entire container from China with, you know, Apple parts on it. Mm. Which, side note, look up the video of the guy who built an Apple phone in China by buying parts.
Really?
Right down to the motherboard, and he even had it laser etched. It's a great video of how he wandered around China and bought all the pieces piece by piece and built an Apple phone out of replacement parts. Yeah. So, and it's very related to that. And that's what Apple's upset about, is the fact that you can do that. So, yeah.
All right. Well, I have, the only other thing I have is my KDE stuff, but KDE Corner can come after you, Tony.
All right. Well, so I was thinking about that, the WannaCry or WannaCrypt, exploit that happened, and, just a few details of what, Tom was talking about, you know, the SMB, you know, that's the, server message block, or it's what Windows, like the Windows file sharing is. You know, when you want a file, or you want to grab a file off another computer, that's the typical what's turned on, and it runs over port 445.
Yeah.
So, but usually, what it's supposed to be is you only share computers that's within your house or within your network. You know, you don't want that just be open across the internet, because there is. Even though you have to type in a username or a password, but it's easily broken. So if it's just open up on the internet, then that's open for all sorts of attacks, and this is one of them. You know, so what it was is in the Shadow Brokers.
Eternal Blue,
right,
from the Shadow Brokers.
Yep, and so that's what made the world aware that this exploit was available. You know, you could attack the SMB on Windows. So what somebody did is they took that and they created the WannaCry, and what you're saying, it's wormable, meaning that once it gets installed on one computer, it reaches out to all the computers it can find on your network or out into the internet, and tries to spread it across that. So any computer that had that turned on, you know, out on the internet, then instantly had it scanned and got that virus.
I just pulled up on Shodan port 445. Still plenty open.
Really?
Yep.
So what it does is it's an encryption kind of, or a ransomware virus. So it encrypts all your data. So the only way to get back from that is either you pay them for the decryption key, or you wipe and you restore from backups.
Yep, and nobody backs up anything, as I've learned. So many people pay the...
They're idiots.
And that's where the beauty of ZFS and things like FreeNAS, where you can just roll back to a previous version. You don't have to go through a full data restore process and stuff. Yeah.
And so maybe you only lose, say, 2% of your stuff, something, depending on the schedule, your backup schedule. You know, maybe you're 1%. Where
exactly?
If you've got 98 to 99% of your stuff, you're not going to pay $15,000 or $10,000.
Well, how fast does ZFS,
whatever it is,
roll back? I mean, like, what's the
rollback almost immediately?
Schedule? Yeah, so you could go look through like the instant that it started encrypting, and just go back to like the few minutes before that. So you almost lose nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, obviously there might be something.
Yeah. But yeah, the ZFS, and of course that comes down to how often you snapshot. So most people are only doing twice a day, once a day, because the snapshots require a certain amount of storage. Oh, so yeah, there's that.
Right. But still, easily daily backups or twice a day backups is much better than
we've even moved up here, not with our snapshots, but with our we do hourly with our database backups now. We realize how much data we produce at a time, and we're like, well, you know, losing a day's worth of data, that's a lot of work for how many employees I have now. So it's one of those things, even I've migrated to hourly backups of database stuff. Just, you know, it make it more and more solid. It's already on RAID arrays. It's already on solid, you know, it's on solid state RAID arrays. Built that. Yeah, that's fun. But yeah, it's backup. That's the best, you know, you do your best to protect it. You can miss something. So you got to make sure your backups are solid.
That's right. And then one of the other things I saw, actually Phil sent us this link, is that OpenVPN, the code for OpenVPN has been audited.
Yes, it has. The 2.4 series code.
Right, 2.4.0.
Did it say who
by audited? By OSTF and Quirks Labs.
Yep. Okay. Well, they're the same people who did the TrueCrypt audit.
Oh, okay.
So that's actually what they do. They're specifically
measure of reliability.
A code. Yeah. They're a pretty big code audit house, and they've audited several other open source projects. Are they the same people that did the OpenSSL audit, too?
I can't remember.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. They're known for opening it.
Right.
So, Tony, OpenVPN. Okay, so that code's been audited, you said?
It has been. And it's not,
what were the results?
In specific, it's the tap driver for Windows, the Windows GUI, the Linux version, and the Linux version.
Okay.
Did it pass? So the results was there was one critical vulnerability, one medium, and then five low. And they have CVE numbers already, you know, ready for that. It says because of the audit, OpenVPN team has issued the number of the fixes already, and so you should be running the 2.4.2 version now has those fixes in it.
2.4.2, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
But a lot of things, I think pfSense is still using 2.3 series, but they backported in some of the fixes. And it was kind of a weird one. I haven't read the vulnerability recently, but I think it's something like a way they found to do a denial of service. Like it was still an edge attack. It wasn't necessarily a code exploit. But, of course, once you start with that, you can lead into.
Right. There was a pre-authorization denial service attack. There's an authorized user denial service attack. There was issues in mbelts, mbed.tls or embed. I don't know. It's a certificate handling system.
Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, I added. We have two different keys. So I have a TLS self-signed key that we sign before you can even talk. You have to have that key before you can do the initiation. And it's one of those extra layers of protection we added. So I think that makes us automatically immune to it. We updated, of course, and we updated our clients. But that was one of the mitigations around it was you create a pre-shared TLS key so you don't have to do a key exchange prior to. So, because normally it uses a standard like a Diffie-Hellman exchange, and I believe with the TLS key it doesn't, which it's an extra layer of security.
Right.
Like first you need the key, and then you need the TLS key.
Won't even start talking.
Won't even start talking.
You prove who you are. Yeah.
Right. That way there's no way to guess it because you can't even open the communication channel with it. I love OpenVPN. I've been used for a while, and adding those extra layers just makes me feel all warm and fuzzy.
Right.
Well, Tom, we're always happy when you feel warm and fuzzy.
Exactly.
So for our non-security friends out there, what it does is, like I said, you have to prove who you are. But it's kind of like if you come up to the back door of some house and you have to like knock a certain way. And then if you do the certain knock, then they'll open up and say who you are. And then you have to prove again who you actually
are.
With
credentials, signed credentials.
Right.
And all this, to get all of this data, we physically have to put it like on either a USB drive or something like that to get that data installed on the computer. So, you know, there's a lot that has to be for one of my laptops that my employees use and go home with. There's a lot of authentication levels that have to go on those. Mm-hmm. So. And then I make sure before I even install that, they have full disk encryption and good, strong passwords before I'll even load it. So I have my procedures.
Yeah, that's good.
A side note real quick. 1.5 million port 445s open, according to Shodan.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So let's just say there's still some open.
Although there is one caveat. Just because it's open doesn't mean it's responding to the SMB service.
Actually, Shodan tells you that it is. Which ones are. Yeah, you can filter it. It really tells you what it's, all the different capabilities, the Unicode, large files port. And it spent a few minutes at Shodan.io and be amazed at the insecurity of the 1.5 million. I'm sure they're not all honeypots either.
Right.
Ooh. That's a lot.
That's a lot. That's an insane number to me. And it tells you, some are non-responsive, but some are giving you, because when you ask a question to port 445, it responds with which version of the protocol, which services are enabled, and everything else. And some of these have all of them enabled. Mm. Some have extended security enabled, some do not. Some are SMB version 1, which is exactly what we're looking for the flaw.
Right.
Yeah. Because SMB version 1 and version 2 both traverse the same port number.
Hmm.
Yeah. Fun times.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's what I had.
Oh, thanks, Tony.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of KDE corner items. One is that their release candidate or beta release of Plasma 5.10 came out last Monday. And I got to tell you, based on what I saw there and the fact that 5.10 is going to be available, I think, in either late May or early June, there's some major changes going on there.
And it's beautiful. And, I watched some of the videos on it. I'm like, wow.
I know.
It's eye candy. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to it. One thing that they've got in there is and by the way, too, I believe that whole Google Drive integration is going to be available by default in 5.10. Right now you have to go and add it. I'm running 5.9 point whatever. I had to install it myself, and there were a couple of little dependencies I had to take care of, a PPA, blah blah blah. I had it running, so it's going to be available by default, which is going to be nice. But there's also a change too as far as the lock screen. They've done some rework of some aspects of it to now place it in the sandbox, which then is going to add some additional security so that you can't use that as an attack vector to bypass the security and then have access to writing files and doing other sorts of nasty things to a system. So they let's see here. Let me see. Yeah, 5.10, it's a new reworked architecture that is now enabled together with something called SecComp. I don't know if you guys are probably familiar with that, maybe. But it's going to it allows them to filter and restrict system calls and those kinds of things, so that if you're trying to unlock your screen, you're not somebody's not going to be able to get in, you know,
sure,
do an end around. So that's kind of exciting to see. But yeah, that 5.10, I've got. Let me just quickly pop over there. The panel task manager is you're going to be able to basically drag and do with your mouse. And again, this is total eye candy, Tom, but you're going to just be able to automatically, if you've got a list of items, it's going to automatically expand so that you don't have to. You remember how you have to single or double click to open things up if you want to put stuff in? It's going to automatically do it for you. So, and also the folder view of the new default desktop is going to automatically be folder view, which you can change because right now I'm running that, but you can switch that as far as the Plasma desktop goes, but just a ton of stuff. I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah, the quality of the software is substantially better. Mm-hmm. Like, I've seen people talking about reviews, and I've interacted with some people talking about it, and they're like, yeah, it's stable now. Like, one person's like, a year ago when I tried it, the audio would kind of randomly decide it didn't want to work, and I have to reboot, or this would decide it didn't want to work, or even when I tried it, I would have that problem where it would crash randomly, and I would just unload and reload it, and it was whenever I was using dual screens. Mm. And I was like, it's just aggravating when you're trying to, you know, especially I do support for clients. I'm like, I can't, hold on, my computer's crashing. And Linux is better.
Right. Yeah.
You know, as boring as Ubuntu is, it is rock solid. Yeah. I mean, I just don't, it's boring, but man, it just works. So.
Yeah, but speaking of audio, they're going to have it where you'll still, let's say, for example, your screen locks, but you were playing some music or something. you'll still be able to adjust that music, turn it off, turn it on, if your screen is locked without having to go in and
from the lock screen.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
So
it looks like they're also, and someone has a project, I don't know it's directly related to KDE, but it's allowing like a music player app that runs. They were showing it in KDE, so I think it's part of the KDE project. But it's basically you can actually throw in YouTube streams and then stream them directly into the player with this,
as opposed
to opening up a web browser. Because a lot of people use YouTube just for the audio, so there's a lot of those YouTube live channels that are playing audio, so they can just pop it in real quick and listen to audio through it and things like that. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the way, too, that feature I discussed where if you're going to try to put a file in a folder and you need to go down the hierarchy, it's called spring loading. So when you drag it up and then it opens, you can put it on another one, it opens there, and then you can just put it in.
Hmm.
Or you can go to the command line.
Very cool.
So that's my my KDE corner. Oh, I already talked about the Google Drive integration. By the way, too, it's going to be a separate icon in the system settings. You know, if you open up the KDE system settings, you've got your major sections, but it sets up a separate little icon in I think it's in your networking, which of course makes a ton of sense. I took some screenshots of it. Actually, it's in personalization. It's called online accounts. So I took a screenshot of it. And I'll provide those in the show notes.
Yeah, you know, it's always been a bug of mine is that Google Drive didn't have integration into Linux because it's a popular product. I know it's not open source, but hey, why not, guys? Dropbox supports it.
Yeah. Right. And speaking of, now you mentioned Google and Linux in the same sentence, Tom. And I wanna say you're probably already aware of this because I think it's been kind of known for maybe about a year. But you know, Google is moving away from Android. They're going to what is it called, Fuchsia?
Yeah. Something.
Fusion. Something like that.
Yeah, they're going to be redoing the whole layer of how Android works, which they're doing it
to
for
get
security.
Away from the GPL. Partially. That's what I've read.
A lot of people think they're doing it for that reason. The reality is they just want to have a focused phone operator because they're adapting Linux to be on the phone. Mm-hmm. If they don't, instead of adaptation, they work directly with the silicon manufacturers and make a dedicated OS that's a whole different animal. Mm-hmm. And there's some advantages to it because they're just going to create an API layer so you can easily do security updates. Because that's one of the problems is it's not an easy path to security updates because of the way they have to roll in drivers. So it makes it hard to update. Well, if they eliminate all that and create a common OS that they work with all the silicon manufacturers for, now the updates and patches become easy to do across all there. So I understand there's the reasoning for it. I just really wish it would be open source.
Yeah, and I'm sure, and I'm sure the silicon manufacturers too. I don't know. Is that me? That's not me.
That's right. It's my fault.
That's all right. And then I think, didn't we see, it's Tizen, isn't it? Isn't that Samsung's phone operating system?
Right.
Which might be an Android, sort of Android, but not Android.
I think it's more based closer to Linux than it is Android is, where it has Linux kernel, but then they've customized it from there.
Okay. Well, I'll be curious to see how that evolves, you know, once Google's got this out and available.
Well, and there becomes a point at which I think there's going to be kind of a convergence of more and more things. Mm-hmm. The HTML5 is so much more powerful and actually has real programming into it that you're going to see where applications are, you just run everything through a web interface, so to speak.
Who cares what you're running underneath it?
Right.
Doesn't matter.
So now it's just
you can open a browser.
I open a browser and I get everything. And that's one of the things we've seen with the way the Xamarin was exporting to all the different platforms with a when we start watching the build keynote, we just export to all these different platforms. Now, it doesn't matter what you open it on, what size screen you open it on becomes irrelevant. And Microsoft realizes that, too. That's why there's such a big push. The operating system's not going to be relevant. That's going to be the same for the phones. We just go to the sites we want. The companies in real time can, instead of pushing out an app update, which is kind of laborsome, just change it on the fly. I mean, Facebook is actually an application running in your browser now. It's not just a website.
Yeah.
Google Plus, the same thing. Look at all the features and cool things you get on there.
Actually, I usually say Facebook is an abomination running in my web browser.
Yeah, it is, but you're running it in your web browser.
HTML5, it is extremely powerful, and I'm sure that I'll get Flash running in it.
Yeah.
that was a joke. What's your take on these sites that still rely on Flash quite a bit?
They don't have they will don't have or won't spend the money on programmers to update it.
Okay.
So one of our giant support headaches is literally that Pogo website, which is a gaming website that it seems like the older retired community really, really loves. And the problem is newer browsers don't have – they've deprecated the support for Flash and Java, and that's what it's all based on. And the company probably doesn't have enough revenue stream realistically to update the site because they're all playing it for free based on ads. The site would have to be completely redone. I think they're redoing parts of it, but it's just like the Yahoo games that finally went away and got deprecated. That caused like an uproar of phone calls.
No, I'm sure.
So I think these companies, once you're tied into it and, you know, the developers are gone or never learned a new language, how do you get it rewritten? It's not like I can just press one button and export my Flash code to HTML5. Not without some tweaking, not without the level of integration that they have where it's a Flash that has API calls that are interactive with other players to play an online poker game, for example.
Yeah.
So there's not like it's just, oh, we're just going to rewrite this because we use tools because I used Flash back in the early 2000s and we re-exported them out to other formats.
Yeah.
But we were just – they were just slideshows. No problem. Swap the slideshow to another format. But when you talk about an entire – they pushed Flash to the limit to write entire game integrations that talked with other players in real time. Well, now you've got something that's not easy to press export on because you have to rewrite the back end of it.
All right. Well, that's pretty good. I don't have anything more.
That's about it. Yeah.
Cool.
I guess we're lurching toward the end of the show.
Careening and flying towards it.
That's another good word, careening.
I like that.
Hey, but Tom, it's controlled careening.
Yes.
The outgoing music for this week's show.
Time for the music.
Music.
So the music this week, I just grabbed it out. No. Just pulled it out.
He carefully
of my...
planned.
Pulled it out of the cloud.
He used a random number generator. What do we got, Tony?
Have you guys heard of the website called CC Hits?
Uh-uh.
And what they do is they go through and find different Creative Commons music.
Oh.
And so they have this hit list of like the songs that I'm not sure whether it's songs that people like on theirs. I think that you have to like click they like it or whatever. So. So I looked through that list, and number two is from 20 Pound Sounds, which I don't have you guys heard of that band before?
No.
Mm-mm.
There's a old podcast I used to listen to, one of the co-hosts was Dan. Did you guys ever listen to the Linux Outlaws?
No.
They have. I used to. That's actually where I started listening to them first.
No, there was,
Fab and Dan.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep, and they. So Dan plays guitar, and this is his band.
Okay.
So the song we're going to play is called Rip It Up. And make sure the volume's turned up. There we go.
Oh, I thought that was the start of the song.
No. Here we go.
Rip it up now.
That's it, right? We're coming to the end of the show.
If you have to ask. No, just kidding. Right. Yes, we are, Tony. We are coming to the end of the show.
That's right. So this has been episode 235.
Lawrence Labs.
That's right, Lawrence Labs.
Yeah. And this is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
And Tom Lawrence.
See you next time.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.